called by the air I breathe. I can't buy the trees. I can't buy the deepest seas. But it don't matter, because they're there for free.
Hello and welcome to the first feature-length edition of A Cornucopia of Tales and Tellers. Today we have Simona. Hello, Simona.
Hello.
And today's very special guest is David Heathfield. Hello, David.
Hi, Alan. Hello, Simona. Good to be here.
So David's here to tell us all about the Around the World in 88 Tales. So David, what was that? And did you take Concorde with you?
Ha-ha. Well, I didn't take Concorde, I didn't take Ali from the World Storytelling Cafe's magic carpet, but we did Zoom all over the place. And yeah, it's you said was, but I'm trying to think of it as is, because I think the project is there, it's existing, it's alive, it's still going on. Even this week, some of Simona's students in Italy have been sharing stories on the Project Padlet. But to tell you what it is, it's a project that I got funding, very fortunately, to be able to meet up with 44 storytellers in 44 different parts of the world and show them objects, museum objects from the Royal Albert Memorial Museum in Exeter. And then with that object, talk a little bit about the object, about where it's from, what it is, but essentially to be inspired to tell a folk tale. So I told a story that I already knew or had learned specifically, and then invited people like you and Simona to tell a story back. And then those were broadcast live on Facebook, and now they are archived. They're a library, if you like, of stories, audio stories online. And there's even a place called Tell Your Stories, where people can add stories that they're inspired to tell by the objects.
So the project, was it originally designed for Zoom and during COVID, or had you aimed it? Was that the aim anyway with storytelling courses?
Definitely came about because of COVID, directly and indirectly. I mean, in my case, personally, I was working at the beginning of COVID, teaching English at linked to the university in Exeter. And for various reasons, at the beginning of 2021, I found myself now fully freelance, having been a part freelance storyteller for years and years. And thinking, I need to generate some income. I got this chance to do a project. It's kind of something I would have always dreamed of doing, even though I'd never thought of it before, but to actually meet up with storytellers around the world had become possibility because of the coronavirus times. You know, the pandemic times allowed the possibility to meet people all over the world, various platforms and storytelling platforms, and particularly running storytelling courses, which took off. And and so I had this golden opportunity, and the museum said yes. They helped me to shape and design the project so that it would work. And they were really keen for the artifacts in the museum to be front and centre of the project, to be able to share these objects with the world. Because, of course, Exeter is a small city, historic city, wonderful objects in the museum, lots coming, of course, from world cultures and directly consequential of colonial times. But of course, the museum, like all museums in this country, are trying to tell the new story, tell the story about, you know, what that object is about, with respect for the culture it comes from. And there are still issues around that. And those are things that were dealt with to some extent during the project. I'll tell you about that a bit more, if you like, as we go on. But there was a really good example with Norman Perrin in Canada, where I showed a First Nation parker, and an interesting conversation ensued.
Which is now available on YouTube, perchance?
It's all there.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Was there any of the items or the artifacts in the museum you thought, oh wow, that just really blew you away for being there? Because with the project, I always remember the crow. I think the crow's got a character of itself now.
Well, interestingly, the crow is not a prominent artifact in the museum. I mean, they've got like 12,000 bird artifacts in the museum. It's got a huge collection, a huge storage space in another part of the city. So only the tip of the iceberg is on display. So what I was able to do is borrow a lot of artifacts and I was given permission to bring them to my home. And I wanted to tell a crow story because crows feature in so many folk tales, so many cultures. So the crow, I've got it here actually, is this beautiful and extraordinary taxidermy object. It was the very first artifact that I shared in the project. And yeah, it's not certainly not a famous artifact in the museum, whereas a lot of the artifacts I did reveal are really precious and unique. So I suppose the objects that blew me away were ones that I've been, you know, I would have walked past hundreds of times because I've done a lot in the museum over the years, but never really paid much attention to.
Mm-hmm.
A good example of that is the King Stainton figure. It's a figure made of wood about, I don't know, a foot or so high, like a doll. But it's obviously not a doll. It's some kind of, probably some kind of icon. And it's from Iron Age Britain, and it was found in a clay pit in the 1800s. And it survived, you know, for the hundreds of years, or thousands of years, a couple of thousand years, in clay. And it's just so mysterious. And if you look closely at it, there's little beads of resin all over it, so it kind of shines when the lights are on it in the museum. And I just found it really a really powerful object, and I told a very kind of philosophical story from Southern Africa, and I was with Philippa Kabali Kagwa from South Africa, who lives in Uganda. No, from Uganda, and she lives in South Africa. Sorry, Philippa. And she responded by telling the most incredible story, and then a conversation ensued where we got very philosophical about the times that we're in during the coronavirus and the importance of tears, because both of us had stories where tears were prominent features. My story was about the moon's tears are the dew that we find in the early morning, and her story was about a guy whose challenge from the king was to make a figure come to life, to create a figure that would come to life. And he said the only way we could do it is if we collect enough tears to make it alive, and not enough tears could be gathered. And we talked about, you know, the grieving that's going on around the world and needs to happen. And because of the crisis we've been going through. So there's a serious moment.
Yeah, I think storytelling has become more important for people in sort of getting through the last 2 years sort of thing.
Well, stories offer us that possibility to deal with the hard topics, the hard moments, because the stories act as metaphors, don't they? And we can, they're slightly displaced, but we can work through stuff. Storytelling can be very therapeutic.
Becomes more manageable then, yeah.
I was wondering, David, how did you choose the objects that you included in the project?
That's a good question. It was a mix. First, my priority was objects that I could handle, and that meant objects that I could borrow. And the museum were happy with that, but they were also saying, well, we also want to showcase some of our unique and special objects. So there was a certain amount of negotiation. But fortunately, I was given free choice. It was my project, so I was able to choose. Because there are some things in the museum which are very important. There's a beautiful set of samurai armor, a complete set from Japan.
So that would be full body size then, yeah?
Full body, incredible.
Wow, okay.
But somehow, when I thought about it, I didn't find... A suit of armor was gave too much information. It was too beautifully designed and too specific. And I was looking for objects which kind of suggested many stories. So, for example, the wooden bowl, which comes from Sudan, is beautiful and simple and made of dark wood and beautifully beveled and patterned. But it could be, it made you think not of that specific part of Africa, but anywhere in the world. It's a bowl, a simple mm-hmm. bowl. So you could tell any story that's about food, or in my case, I told the story of the magic bowl from India. So the story wasn't, even though the object came from Africa, my story was from India. So the story could act as a springboard into any story from anywhere. And it didn't give you too much information. So that was an important criteria for me. It was a bowl.
Yeah.
It was a sword. It was, in your case, Simona, a pot. You told a beautiful story about a pot. In Alan's case, it was a horse, because I showed a...
it was the Greek toy horse, yeah. Do you think that's important then to... I mean, we'll get to this in another podcast, because I remember in your book, I'm sounding like a fanboy here. In your book, you talked about you don't want to use too many props or imagery for students, because the imagination is actually the most important thing you have in storytelling, or the listener's imagination, as it were. So it's easier to keep it to just the noun, bowl, horse, as opposed to a very specific, this is a samurai outfit. What's the word? Yeah.
Exactly. The less is more idea. Just one simple artifact just launches us into a story. So, the minimal input, but so much came out of it. It was extraordinary.
Did you designate the items to any specific individual that you knew, or was it picking them out of a hat?
Yes and no. Sometimes there were reasons why I allocated certain artifacts to certain people, but I never imposed it. So I gave people a choice, and a few people chose not to know the object before I met them. The famous Mr. John Rowe from the World Storytelling Cafe was one of those people who I sprang an Afghan cap on him, and he immediately came back with a story. Great story. But most people said, actually, I think I would like to know the object in advance and have a bit of preparation. So in most cases, I suggested an object. And in most cases, people said, yes. And in a few cases, people said, I'm not sure about that object. And then we talked. And sometimes they had an idea that of a particular story they wanted to share. So I found an object that fitted what they wanted to share. In many cases, I suggested one object. They said, maybe not that one. And I said, well, what about this one or this one? And they said, yes, this one. So it was a kind of a bit of negotiation.
Have you given all the stuff back to the museum yet?
No, tomorrow.
Okay.
And it is tomorrow. Tomorrow is the day when I return my, I've got about 70 objects in total. I mean, there are many that I didn't use in the project. I just borrowed as much as I was allowed. So there are actually lots of artifacts just upstairs in a few baskets and boxes that are yet to appear.
So it is only phase one of the project is being finished then. It's nowhere near a finished project.
I could tell you about a project that I'm arranging or putting in a bid for at the moment, but I'm going to keep it under my hat.
Ooh. Is that John Rowe's hat or your hat?
Yeah, I wanted to comment on that. Like, is there a specific reason why you chose an Afghan cap for John Rowe? Is it because he always wears a hat?
Yes, there was that was part of the choice, a hat. And John, I really respect John Rowe for his embracing of diversity. That's something that's incredibly important to me, and I think a lot of storytellers do this, but I think John Rowe is very good at bringing people in from different cultures, different backgrounds. So And John is very sensitive to what's going on in different parts of the world. He's an activist as well as a storyteller. So to be bringing in a story from a culture like Afghanistan, also with the recent history, we didn't go into that in the story share, but I felt confident that it would be fine.
I think that brings us sort of to our next point then, because the project, you did bring together 44 storytellers, and I think the only place there wasn't one was Antarctica.
There were a few other places where we didn't reach. I mean, 44 doesn't cover everywhere. But I tried
to definitely nail the continents.
I tried to spread it fairly evenly around the world. Again, in Canada, we had Norman Perrin, who's of white European heritage, and Amna Burki, who's of North India, Pakistani heritage. So that kind of diversity was very important through the project as well.
How have you found the response then on the ground in the Royal Albert Memorial Museum then, both for visitor and for staff?
It's been wonderful. I mean, the main contact there really has been with the live events. So you and Simona and many of the people who've been involved as storytellers, you haven't been to the museum in most cases. A few of you have visited. One person, Sanja Raskovic in Croatia, has been to the museum a few times because she comes to Devon, or used to come to Devon, with groups of students. But so there's two stories, really. There's the story that you know, which is the remote virtual version of the experience. And then there's another version that I know very well, which has been the in-person events. And they went on through the project and kind of came to a climax in November, the last month, where I did a lot of in-person storytelling, family events and adult events. And it was extraordinary, an extraordinary response. Absolutely wonderful. I mean, I'd love to share with you things that people said about the project.
Absolutely. Feedback's always good.
Well, it's just been mind-blowing. I've just been compiling a kind of writing down what people, just compiling comments people make. I gave evaluations to people who came to live events, paper evaluations, just talking about the aims of the project and inviting comments. And also I did similar evaluations for people who participated as storytellers, and I did other ones for people who participated online. And I just got lots of feedback, incredibly. I mean, totally positive. And a lot of it, you wouldn't just call it positive, you'd say it's kind of just incredible, you know, feedback, people being very blown away. And sometimes, you know, even seems to be kind of life-affirming, life-changing in some cases. I mean, in terms of well-being, what did people like? Live at last, you know, people coming to a live event having been in lockdown for so long. Live at last, such a timely, appropriate, inspiring project. Family events. I've never seen a group of young children have their attention held and their imagination inspired for such a long period of time. And at the last event, a family event that I did in the museum, Sika Gurung from Nepal was beaming in live on Zoom and interacting with the audience alongside me. And, you know, what people loved, the live feed with the storyteller in Nepal, to meet a storyteller from Kathmandu, the connection to Nepal, opportunity to ask questions. Great to welcome people from all over the world, bringing the world to Exeter. I mean, people found that so exciting, you know, to meet live with a person. And you know, one child, you know, I think she was 7 years old. I liked seeing a person from a different country. So, you know, that awareness that this is actually, we can do this now. You know, it's become normal suddenly to be able to interact across the globe.
How did you find the reaction from the spontaneity face-to-face to the feedback online? Because the feedback online is around the world, whereas it's like teaching where you read a room instantly.
It is different. I mean, I found it very exciting because I hadn't, though those first events I did live in the back garden of the museum in August were the very first live events I've done for nearly 2 years.
That dog is 2021, yeah.
Storytelling face to face has been my bread and butter as a storyteller for the last 18 years. You know, it's what I've been, a professional storyteller. So to actually be back in the live space was incredibly exciting. And that last event with Seeker, it was like there was a festival going on in the museum. I mean, we were in this little gallery, and people were leaning over the balconies upstairs, and people were coming and standing at the back, and what's going on? It was like a party that was going on. And that was partly Seeker just beaming through the screen. And she pulled the most incredible faces, and it had a monster in it. It had a Rakshas, which is a Nepalese monster, and she was kind of acting out this monster with, you know, drool and red burning eyes, and she actually, I mean, literally seemed to transform into this Nepalese monster in front of our eyes, and came right up to the screen, and the kids, you know, it was just amazing.
Where does this leave storytelling now with projects like this? Because, I mean, it's going to have to be blended, isn't it? Because it's been so successful online and offline, you can't just say, okay, you guys can't join in anymore. It has to be, we all have to take part.
I don't know, Alan. I don't know what's going to happen. We have to wait, watch this space. I mean, I was asked just before I finished teaching to do hybrid teaching, where I was going to be teaching students in the classroom and teaching students online at the same time. And I balked at the idea. I said, I can't do that. I'm not doing that. It's one or the other, not both. Because I left for whatever reason, that I never experienced it. So I kind of came away with a prejudice. But now suddenly I'm doing it as a storyteller, and it's pretty exciting.
I think there's a difference there between teaching and storytelling, because generally the attention's on new storytelling, whereas teaching, I remember walking into work last year, and if you had a post-it note on your desk going, by the way, you're hybrid at 2 o'clock, you kind of pretend to cough a little bit more.
You're experiencing that at the moment, and it's not good at all.
I know. I think teaching is so complex. I mean, there's a beautiful simplicity about storytelling. You know, you're there, you're a person, you're telling a story. You don't need much technology. It's a different question, really.
But at the same time, technology has driven this project at the same time, hasn't it?
It has. It has been incredibly integral to this project. And I've been the technophobe all my teaching career, the person who goes into the classroom and switches the screen off and says, we don't need any of that, let's do face-to-face. So to find myself now being, you know, people talking about me as, oh, he's the Zoom storyteller, or he, you know, it's there's a kind of irony in that. But for me, the beauty of just communicating around the world, and I mean, in tandem with the project, I've been running, before the project, I've been running, as you know, storytelling courses for teachers around the world, and just teachers meeting up from South Korea, Peru, Turkey, Palestine, all over the world, and in the same space, in the same time. It's been absolutely fantastic. And the sharing of cultures and the realization that storytelling transcends borders. We all knew it already, but the lived experience has been fantastic, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think there's been a difference this year with the contact lists. There's very little Irish people on my phone. none of them are here. They're all everywhere else.
But can I just say one more thing that people said that's been really significant to me? Because one of the objectives, one of the aims of the project was well-being and reducing loneliness and feeling connected, bringing people together, and sustaining people from diverse heritages and diverse circumstances as well. And in the audience, people were very honest in some of the feedback they gave. I mean, just some comments. People said, this was a magical, inspirational, wise experience, a therapeutic experience. I feel less lonely. It was great to see children from different backgrounds all enjoying the stories. I'm more relaxed now than I was before. This is just after an event. And one person said, I've been isolated and very alone for many months. I have EUBPD, that's emotionally unstable personality disorder, and bipolar disorder. This has been wonderful. I feel alive again. Thank you. I mean, you know, when someone writes that at the end of a, and I, you know, I didn't know this person had this experience. And then to read that afterwards, it's very moving to realize the power that we can wield as storytellers. And the, not storytellers, but the, what the story wields, what the story can bring. And another feature of the project was it was mostly free. The events were mostly free. And that was complicated to arrange. But because in the museum, usually they charge for events. But because of pandemic, we were trying to build the audiences up again and trying to make it very inclusive. And that was a really important thing for me, to include people. And, you know, one parent wrote, we're a low income family and it being free makes a difference. So that in kind of a sense of inclusiveness, it's free on Zoom, it's free on the museum website, it's free to come to the events. And that kind of opening doors was really a vital part, I think.
Especially phrases like that you would get with feedback. That stuff sticks with you. A long time as well, yeah. That's the kind of stuff that can you hear, but then it silences a room sort of thing. So where's the project going next then? Or what do you think is going to emerge from, let's call it, stage one of Around the World?
I'm still, the jury's out, Alan. I'm still not sure what I think it's not one thing. I think it's going to be strands going in different directions. I mean, already there's been exciting things happening. Georgiana Popan in Romania, even while the was so quick off the mark, even while the project was going on, she contacted me. So I'm so inspired. I'm starting a project already in Romania. So it, rather than being a global project, what she was doing in Romania is in her city, working with the local museum, she was starting to tell stories online with a museum expert. So the museum expert would talk about the artifact, she would tell the folktale, and it was being beamed into schools all over Romania. And that was, you know, that started happening within the lifetime of my project. But it'd been inspired by this project. So it's just, wow, how do you do that? You know, it's just like instant response. I mean, Georgiana's a well-established storyteller in Romania. But that is an example. And then teachers, lots of people who were teachers were involved as storytellers. Both of you were teachers, both of you were storytellers. And exciting comments from teachers about what they're doing with the project. I mean, Simona, you know, is, like I said, has just been getting her students listening to stories and then finding stories of their own choice, rehearsing them, and then sharing them on the project Padlet so that they can comment on each other's stories. I can comment on their stories. Everybody can comment on their stories. So, you know, that this isn't the next step. This is still part of this project, but I think it's going to go in lots of different directions. And Cora Teske in Germany, I'm using the videos with my students to help them broaden their horizons. Maria Teresa Continanza in Argentina said, I use this project as a link with a section of the course book I'm using. How can we remember the past? She wrote. Museums and stories together made this unit enjoyable and motivating for the students. We planned a trip to Exeter. We made the plane tickets. We packed our suitcases and we bought the museum tickets. We visited the city and we went to the museum. Can you imagine the students' excitement? For many classes, we visited the online museum, discovering ancient objects, speaking about them, comparing them, speaking about their materials, speculating about their past owners. Then, choosing stories for the Padlet, listening to them, retelling them, working with them. It's a creative and amazing resource for teachers all around the world. Thank you. I mean, you know, when you read that, you're thinking, wow, you know, you're having a real impact on someone's own, well, not just their teaching practice, but their learner's experience, something very concrete that they can grasp and you know, work with their imagination. They went to the museum virtually. Fantastic.
I think I've just found the next project for a kids group. I might steal that.
Absolutely. Do it.
That's great because, you know, we were talking about this with my students when we did this project when they have to put their stories on the Padlet. And what we discussed is how great it was to take part in a real project because on their course books or on the texts that they read, you always read or listen to things that are imaginary and are just created for the course book, but they were actually reading and taking part in a real project that was similar to the project that they usually work on, they usually read about, and their excitement was just incredible.
Wow, that makes all the difference, doesn't it? And it's great. That's great to hear, Simona.
So that, yeah, it gives it soul, like, doesn't it?
David, there. They were talking about you. They were excited to be part of this. It was great.
Could you just say a bit more? I'm enjoying listening to you. Can you tell me more about what they did and what their experience was?
Well, you know, it's hard to get 13 and 14 years old students to be excited about stories. But I introduced this Padlet project more as a challenge to them. Like it was like, oh, you can listen and then tell a story and you're taking part in a real project. You can do this. And I didn't actually, this is me talking from a teacher point of view of students that come into the class and say, oh, I didn't have time to do that. You know, I had a lot of homework at school. I didn't really have time to do that. And I wasn't expecting all of them to come with a story. And I was so surprised when at the lesson I had planned to do this project in, all of them were there with a story. And some of them, all of them. There were seven of them, all of them with a story.
I've done so many storytelling projects over the years, and that's an achievement, Simona. If every student has come with a story, that is, you have inspired them.
Yeah, well, you have inspired them, actually, because they listen to your stories. And they were like,
let's call them our story, shall we?
Yeah, our stories, right. Because, you know, they listen to it. And then when they share their stories, I heard them commenting about, I need to see if David commented on my story. I need to see what he wrote. I'm a superstar. You know, I'm famous now. I'm part of this project. They were super excited about it. It was great. It was great to see their excitement.
That's cool. That's great.
I went the other way in my lessons because I went with storytelling, which then got them into graded readers because I wanted them reading more or voluntarily reading something that wasn't just a textbook and it wasn't on a screen. Simona, I actually stole your idea because do you remember you were doing, were you doing Fionn McCool,
yeah.
And with comparatives and superlatives, I did that with them and then turned that into the introduction for a book club. And they read something like six books.
It can take us in many, many, many directions. And for a lot of people, I think it's the connections. I think the connectivity is the key. I mean, I've been talking about audience members who came to the museum, but can I also just tell you about people who've been online audiences? And there's a a woman called Helga Beer here in Exeter, and it's great actually, because I never met her face to face, and she didn't come to any of the live events, but she got in touch with me, and we're probably putting together something at the moment. But she wrote, "I felt so grateful to be connecting with women from Gaza or many of the other countries involved in the project. It made the world seem smaller again, and the people so much closer." She said, "I loved watching the Zoom recordings. It felt like I was there. And seeing that we are still connected despite COVID, wars, politics, and the many other things which seem set on creating more division and distance. Having felt very isolated here in the UK, I felt through the stories I was connected once more to people in other countries. It was a relief to feel that once more." So, I mean, you know, wow, you know, people just feeling so connected. And she was in Exeter, so the city where I am, but engaging online. And equally, there's a young woman I know called Kimaya Gurung, who's just turned 15. And Kimaya lives in Kathmandu. You might know her grandmother. Her grandmother is called Bina Gurung. Kimaya said this: "This project feels like home to me and a hug to my heart. I feel a strong sense of connection, unity and love with people from all around the world. I'm absolutely thrilled to have come across this project and I'm abundantly grateful." 15, she's saying that. I mean, isn't it amazing?
It's nice because it just makes the distances from there to here feel like next door. It's delightful.
For Helga here in Exeter, for Kimaya there in Kathmandu, it's the same distance. It's the same distance because we're all here immediately, you know.
New community.
In Exeter, one of the live events I did, well, two of the live events I did were in the library, and they were family events. And I teamed up with a good friend of mine called Sundi Adave. And she works for Devon Development Education. So she herself is of Gujarati heritage from India. And she does a lot of projects with people who live in Exeter and the surrounding area who are from diverse heritages. And she heads up Global Champions. So people go into schools and they talk about their heritages, they talk about their foods, their cultures, their history, their music. And they just, it's working anti-racism, pro-diversity. She does fantastic projects. I've known Sundia for years, and she's a great storyteller. So in the library, she joined me, and we did two events. And one of them was just before Halloween and just before Diwali. So we had Festival of Light and kind of Halloween, November the 5th, sort of the very English sort of light celebrations, November the 5th and fire. But one of the events there, we had a very diverse families coming in, people from many heritages coming into the library. She said, "The live tellings brought together people from many diverse backgrounds, some of whom had never been to storytelling before or been in a space that was so multicultural and intergenerational. Some knew they were going to hear a story from their own cultural background and expressed how this was important to them and their children to be represented, for example, the Diwali story at Diwali time. It allowed the younger listeners to take part actively and share their heritage, thus supporting the parents and elders to sustain it. The project provided the opportunity for each member from a different cultural background to learn and listen to another culture's background, and within this, finding themes of commonality as well as differences." I love that quote because that's, for me, was one of the most important parts of the project as well. It's not just connecting across the globe, but connecting within communities where there's sometimes division. And I don't know, you're probably aware that there's been a lot of talk during pandemic times of people, young people, accessing very harmful materials online, building walls, building barriers between people. It's so necessary to use this platform of storytellers to keep breaking down these barriers and say, actually, you know, we've got this amazing commonality. We have the same themes in our stories about kindness, about acceptance, about tolerance, about equality, about justice. It's the details in the stories that distinguish the cultures, which are wonderful, the richness of the differences. But it's this commonality, this common humanity, that we can do this through storytelling. I'm about to do a project here in Exeter with kids who are excluded, kids who are have social workers allocated to them. And, you know, so it's not just across cultural backgrounds, heritage backgrounds, but also across sort of socioeconomic backgrounds as well. Storytelling can break through those barriers, really.
I think that's the thing, isn't it, with the storytelling in general, where it's not just the geographical distances, but, you know, like I get quite academic in these things. So it's when you trace back a story. I love looking for the roots of a story. Like we've talked before about, there's a story that's, you know, some people will claim it's Nepalese, some will claim it's West African. But then I looked into it and found, well, actually it might be Irish, it might be from Derry or something. You know, the two farmers, that one. But then, like, if you look at mythology as well, and the history of where the mythology goes, you know, Celtic mythology is actually the same as Hindi mythology because they're from the same source material, and they've even the same characters, slightly different names and spellings. And then that's obviously the divide of languages as well.
Yeah.
I think there's a whole massive array of discussion to be had on how far back everything goes, and it's probably all from the same place.
Which
sort of helps break down barriers again.
Absolutely. It's absolutely fascinating to look at variants of the same story around, you know, from one village to the next. But like you say, between Nepal and Ireland, you can have the same story as well.
Yeah, just slightly different characters. Yeah. Would you have a little story for us to finish off on that you may have taken from the museum?
Yeah, I have actually. I mean, I've been retelling some of the stories I learned during the project. But I didn't just learn stories from the 44 storytellers. Like I mentioned earlier, there's been occasions where when Sundia and I were in the library, I learned Diwali stories from her, and that story's not on the YouTube playlist. And meeting people one-to-one. One family we were in the library, and there's a beautiful rocking horse. And one of the events we did, it coincided with the unveiling of the restored rocking horse. It had been out of action for several months and had been restored. And so I included it in a story about riding to the stars. And one family told a story about the rocking horse, that the same guy who had made the rocking horse for the library, they'd got him to make a rocking horse for their grandchildren. And all these little personal stories, there's so many stories. But a lot of stories are being shared, like Simona's students. A lot of stories are being shared now on the Padlet. And one of the first people to share a story on the Project Padlet was a young woman that I've got to know really well through the World Storytelling Cafe, a girl called Jasname, who's from Punjab in India. And she's a fabulous storyteller. And every week she tells one new story, sometimes two. I mean, it's just unbelievable. She's been doing this for months. She's got an incredible...
It puts all of us to shame. She's unbelievable. Yeah. She's
unbelievable. And she put a story up early. The very first artifact, as I mentioned earlier, was the crow. And I told a story that I learned from Heba Hamuda from Palestine. Wonderful story, never walk with evil. And Hend Kata, also from Gaza, responded by telling the story of Darwish, a wonderful comic story about husband and wife. But then on the Padlet, there appeared a story from Jasname about the crow, Ka. Ka. And I'm going to try and tell it, but I've never told this before. I haven't even rehearsed this, really. So I'm going to try and tell it. All of you who just get brave enough to share stories, it doesn't have to be perfect. Just tell the story that comes to your mind. Add stories to the Padlet. Keep telling stories that you learn from the project. So this is the story of Chibi and Ka. And in Punjab, Chibi means sparrow, tiny little bird, And ka means crow. Ka! Crow. Are you ready?
Absolutely.
Story, story.
Tell us a story.
Chibi, the little sparrow, flew next to the wide river and saw some land. Oh, I want to grow some wheat. And Chibi the sparrow flew to Ka, the crow. Ka, will you help me to grow some beautiful wheat on the land next to the river? Will you help me to plough the land and sow the seed? And Ka answered, wearing my socks, I come dancing, dancing. You go and I come, Ka! So Chibi went to the field and Chibi began to plough the field. But Ka didn't come. And Chibi sowed the seeds, but Ka didn't come. Time passed. Chibi flew to Ka and said, Ka, it's time to water the land so that the wheat grows tall and strong. Ka, will you help me to water the land? And Ka said, wearing my socks, I come dancing, dancing. You go and I come, Ka! And Chibi flew to the land, and there Chibi, she began to sprinkle water so that those shoots that were sprouting would continue to grow tall and straight. But Ka didn't come. Chibi went round pulling out some of the weeds that were growing among the wheat. But Ka didn't come to help her. Now time had passed, and the wheat had grown tall and straight, and it had golden ears. It was ready to be harvested. Chibi went to harvest the wheat, but Ka had already been, and Ka had harvested all the wheat, and Ka had taken all of the grain. Oh, Chibi had done all of the work, and Ka, the crow, had taken all of the grain. Chibi was so sad. Black clouds appeared in the sky. A storm was brewing and it began to rain. The rain fell heavy. The storm was wild. Chibi, the little sparrow, she picked all of those stalks of wheat and the chaff and she wove them into a nest to protect herself. And there she lasted out the storm. But Ka, who had gathered all of the grain next to the river, greedy Ka, suffered. Because the rains fell and the river rose and the river burst its banks. And in the flood, all of the grain and Ka, the crow, the greedy crow, were washed away. And Jasname, who tells me this story, says, you reap what you sow.
Such a great tale. Brilliant.
Isn't it fantastic? So Jasname, you are my teacher. I love learning stories from people of all ages, from everywhere. That's my passion. That's my joy. And there's somebody that you two might have heard of. His name is Charles Hadfield, and Charles and his wife Jill Hadfield have published lots of things about English language teaching. And Charles is a friend, and he wrote about the achievement of this project. I'm just going to read what Charles wrote just to finish. This project shares joy. In these weird pandemic times, it really sparked joy and helped people make links around the globe. Thank you, everyone. You said, where's this project going, and Alan? I don't know where it's going, but here's one idea from Leti Segura in Mexico. And I've got good news. Leti Segura is joining the next Crest course starting in a couple of weeks' time. And I asked, how do you imagine this project developing, or what new project could emerge? And she said, I can imagine a project where all countries all around the world could join using their own languages and English, both versions. Wouldn't that be great?
Oh, that'd be really nice.
That would be really nice, wouldn't it?
I would leave you with a nice warm feeling inside. Well, there's been a few successful bilingual stories in the past, hasn't there? Ish. Yeah. I mean, David, well, you've done
I mean, it's part
Spanish
of the project.
Well.
I mean, yeah. The best example is that very first story told by Hend, where she told it, you know, Arabic, English, switching back and forth, and it was just perfect, you know. And she did that again at a live event at Crediton Arts Centre. Crediton's a small town near Exeter, where I have got a lot of connections. And it was an adult audience. There were a few children, but it was mostly adults. And she was on first because we knew she would lose power by, you know, 10 o'clock in Gaza, the electricity switched off. So at 7:30 UK time, which was 9:30 Gaza time, she told her story and then had an exchange of a conversation with the audience. And she did that again. She told Darwish in English and Arabic, and people were just blown away to be meeting somebody in Gaza, not only meeting them, but just being told this absolutely fabulous story. And not just a story in English and Arabic, but she was playing the oud at the same time. You know, wow, what better treat could there be?
Always very jealous of Hen's teaching and storytelling abilities. It's just phenomenal. In multiple languages as well. It's absolutely phenomenal.
And playing the oud at the same time. I got a quote from another young child. She said, when in the library, I told the story about the rocking horse. And while I told it, she rode on the rocking horse. And in the story, it was all about the girl who found her way to the stars in the sky. And when at the end I was asking for evaluation, I had some simple questions for the kids to answer. And she said, I liked the girl who rode to the stars because I got the part in the story.
Was she allowed on a museum piece?
That actually wasn't a museum piece. This was we've got to be flexible with these things. We were in the museum. Sorry, we were in the library, the central library. But this horse is about 50 years old. I think it was called its Jubilee event. Yeah, so it was unveiled that day. So I deliberately told this story where each time I told the story, I told it three times during the day. One of the children was riding the horse up to the stars. And, you know, for this girl, you could see she was on her way to the stars, you know. It's just magical.
Nice.
I love storytelling online, but there is something incredible as well about just being able to move around in the space and engage with that. Simona, thank you ever so much for being part of the project, and for all of the 44 storytellers. You know who you are, from Ralph Mama, from Benin, from Harry Kucha Kucha, who comes from Cameroon, An Suk Kim, South Korea. You know, it's just been absolutely fabulous. Glenda Gallardo in Peru. What a treasure it's been, you know.
Thank you for bringing us all together. So thank you very much, David, for coming to the podcast and answering some of our questions and talking about the Around the World in 88 Tales project. It's been amazing. And we hope you listeners enjoyed the podcast. We'll be back soon with another episode. It's a surprise episode. Well, good night.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye, good morning, good night. I can't buy the trees. I can't buy the deepest seas, but it
don't matter, 'cause they're there for